Hello, everyone, and welcome to On Science, a weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk. I'm Adam Cole, a production assistant here. On this week's show, Changing Life. From the depths of evolutionary history to the depths of space, we'll hear about an ancient shrew-like creature that made the first step towards large mammalian brains, and a modern rat, deemed extinct, who made a surprise reappearance. Some scientists are sending creatures into space, while others search for life that's already out there. And a new study shows that negative gossip can change the way we see someone. Literally. First up, we humans tend to brag about our large brains, but in fact most mammals, from aardvarks to zebras, have big brains for their body size. Scientists have long wondered what evolutionary forces pumped up the mammal brain so much. Christopher Joyce reports on a new explanation. Mammals needed to smell better.
Not smell better as in, hey, I need a deodorant, but smell better as in, I think there's food nearby. Or, gee, is that a hungry dinosaur just upwind of me? Tim Rowe, a paleontologist at the University of Texas, says part of the mammal brain grew larger as mammals became better sniffers. The evidence comes from the skulls of two kinds of reptile that lived about 200 million years ago. The skulls are the size of paper clips. They're from China, and they're a kind of reptile believed to have evolved into the first mammals.
We looked at them and went, wow, I mean, these are crown jewels. But they were so tiny, and all that we could do was put them behind a microscope and study their external surfaces.
That was over two decades ago. Rowe asked if he could break open the crania and make a cast of the inside to see the shape of the brain that once sat there. The fossil owners said no way. So Rowe waited decades until he developed a way to make a digital image of the inside of the cranium using a CT scanner like those used in medicine. Rowe made brain images of several specimens that lived millions of years apart, and he noticed that the brains changed over time. The smelling part, the olfactory bulb, kept growing.
We could see a huge increase in the size of the olfactory bulbs. And behind the olfactory bulbs,
where the brain processes signals from the bulb,
we could see this region of the brain also got really, really large.
Over millions of years, the whole olfactory apparatus got bigger. And so did parts of the brain that process tactile information, not from skin, but from hair, one of the things all mammals have. Hair wasn't just for warmth. It provided mammals with important information.
They were moving in and out of burrows and up and down on trees, and their hair offered a lot of sensory information that helped them balance and navigate and move through this environment.
So mammals, whose brains made them better smellers and movers, survived better. But then why did mammals develop super smell and touch? I mean, everyone needed a leg up in that dog-eat-dog world. Well, Rowe suggests this. It was a dinosaur's world back then. Dinosaurs probably hunted during the day, so it behooved tasty little mammals to stay out of sight till it got dark.
So once the dinosaurs had bedded down for the night, that's when the mammals came out and started sniffing around for insects, insect larvae, and things that lived in the soils, like worms.
At night, smelling and feeling were more useful than, say, good vision. Glenn Northcutt, a neurobiologist at the University of California at San Diego, notes that other parts of the brain in these reptiles were growing too, areas for motor coordination, for example. He says all these changes actually may be part of the evolution of something bigger than smell or touch, warm-bloodedness. Warm-blooded animals didn't need the sun.
The advantage is that it allows you to operate, to use the world at times that reptiles can't.
Northcutt says questions about the deep past like this are hard to answer, but they're fun.
We all are interested in where we came from and how we came to be.
The research appears in the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Gossip has a bad reputation, but many scientists believe it helped our early ancestors get ahead. Now scientists have found evidence that our brains are actually wired to respond to gossip. A new study shows that scuttlebutt can change the way our visual system responds to a face. But as John Hamilton reports, That's only true when the juicy detail conveys something negative.
We all gossip. Lisa Feldman Barrett of Northeastern University says it's really just another way you get information about people.
Gossip is helping you to predict who is friend and who is foe. You know, who should I compete with? Who should I avoid? Who should I play with? That kind of thing.
Barrett is part of a team that's been studying how gossip affects not just what we know about an unfamiliar person, but how we feel about them.
So if I just tell you this person stole a wallet or this person helped an old woman across the street, would that actually change your basic feelings about that person?
Not surprisingly, the answer is yes. And Barrett says that raised a new question. Once hearsay has predisposed us to see someone in a certain way, is it possible that we literally see them differently? That may seem like a strange thing to ask, but Barrett says the human brain has a whole lot of connections between regions that process visual information and areas involved in our most basic emotions. So the team did another experiment.
Subjects would come in and we would present them with structurally neutral faces paired with descriptions of behavior.
Some of these faces got paired with a negative behavior, like stole money from a friend. Other faces were associated with more positive actions. Then the researchers looked to see how the volunteers' brains responded to the different kinds of information. They did this by showing the left and right eyes of each person very different images.
So in one eye, you might show a face, and in the other eye, you might show a house.
The human brain can only handle one of those images at a time, so it unconsciously tends to linger on the one it considers more important. And Barrett says in this experiment, the volunteers' brains were most likely to fix on faces associated with negative gossip.
Gossip doesn't just influence your opinions about people. It actually influences how you see them visually.
The findings suggest we are hardwired to pay more attention to a person if we've been told they are dangerous or dishonest or unpleasant. Other scientists say that makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. Frank McAndrew is a professor of psychology at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois.
I was actually pretty excited to see this paper because for years, people like me have been saying that our intense interest in gossip is not really a character flaw. It's part of who we are. It's almost a biological event, and that it exists for good evolutionary reasons.
McAndrew says even when primitive humans lived in small groups, it was important to know things like who might hurt you or who was after the same mate you were. And learning those things through personal experience would have been slow and potentially dangerous. So McAndrew says one shortcut would have been gossip.
People who had an intense interest in that constantly were monitoring who's sleeping with who and who's friends with whom and who you can trust and who you can't, came out ahead. People who just didn't care about that stuff got left behind.
And McAndrew says it makes sense that our brains pay special attention to negative gossip.
If somebody's a competitor or somebody is higher than you in the food chain, you want dirt about them. You want negative information because that's the stuff you can exploit to get ahead.
The new study is published online by the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Ursula. What's a story? Morning glory. What's a tale? Nightingale.
Did you hear about Hugo and Kim?
Hi, Margie.
Hi, Alice. What's a story? Morning glory. What's a word? Hummingbird.
Have you heard about Hugo and Kim?
For more than a century, scientists had seen no sign of the red-crested tree rat. It's a guinea pig-sized animal with a fiery red patch of fur on its head and a long black-and-white tail. Then, 2 weeks ago, one of the tree rats nearly walked up to Lizzie Noble, a conservation volunteer in Colombia. Noble joined Talk of the Nation host Jennifer Ludden from El Dorado, Colombia.
So how did this happen? When did you see the little guy?
It's kind of crazy. We were just, there's two of us volunteering here. We were just heading off to bed one evening, and it just crawled up the stairs towards us and just quite happily sat there and looked at us. And we looked at it and realized it was something special because it's got distinct features and quite interesting markings.
Well, it's called a rat, but it doesn't really look like that. What does it look like?
No, it looks more like a guinea pig, I guess, with a long hairy rat tail. And it's got different segments of color. So the head was a fiery red and the body was a different red. And the tail, the end of the tail looked like it'd been dipped in white paint. So it was quite interesting to look at. Very cute.
But did Cupid, did you have any idea this was something special?
We knew it was something different and something you don't see every day, but we didn't realize how special it was. Otherwise, I think we would have tried to keep it around the place, but we just quite happily took photos and thought, oh, we'll find out what it is later.
Okay, now you did find out what it was. You emailed photos, is that right? And we also are joined by the person who confirmed that this was something special. Paul Salomon is the Director of Conservation for World Land Trust USA. When Lizzie Noble spotted that creature that some are calling the Pokemon rat, she sent the images to Paul to find out what it was, and he joins us from his office in Northern Virginia. Welcome.
Hi there, Jennifer.
I can imagine you must have been frustrated because you had actually sent a team to look for this red-crested tree rat in 2007. Is that right?
That's right. We spent 2 years looking for this critter, and we knew it was very special, and the last hope of finding it was in the El Dorado Reserve. But, of course, when I received the email and opened up the picture, I was just ecstatic. I instantly knew what it was, and I immediately got on Skype and contacted Lizzie there and told her what she had.
Now, tell me, why is this creature so unique?
Because it is a monotypic genus, which means that it's not just a unique species, it's to a higher level, taxonomic level. In other words, in its relations within the family of rodents is very unclear. It's got some unique characteristics that are not shared by other species, so it really is very special. And, of course, it's only found in this one area in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta of northern Colombia. It's the only place to find it.
And, in fact, the last time it was sighted, am I correct, 113 years ago it was in this area?
1898, that's correct.
How do you verify? I mean, is it just the site? How else have you been able to verify this is it?
Oh, from the type description, when it was originally described 110 years ago, they gave a good description and information, and on the basis of that, we were able to identify it. But also, it's in a very unique area. There's no other species similar to it, and this is a pretty distinctive critter.
Are you going to send another team to try and find it again?
Well, Lizzie's there.
Lizzie, going to change your plans?
I'm quite happy here looking for it. I'm having a great time.
Are you really going out? Now, you've been working with the Pro Avis Foundation down there, which is a big nature reserve. Are you kind of changing plans to go look for this again?
We put out a few mammal traps, and we're going out every night trying to find it. And we're hot on the case, but we're not quite there yet. I'm hopeful soon.
What happens if you do?
If we find it,
yeah.
We'll try and keep one so that we can get DNA samples, and we'll get hold of Paul and see if we can get someone with more knowledge on tree rats out here, I guess.
And Paul, what would that mean if the red-crested tree rat is alive and well, if there's more than one?
Well, yes, that's the key. We really need to establish the status of this. It is a very special species. It's only found in this last refuge in the nature reserve, El Dorado Nature Reserve, which is a wonderful ecotourism destination. But we really need to establish how many there are and start implementing conservation actions. We're particularly worried that there's a feral cat population in the area, and they will almost certainly prey on this guinea pig-sized rodent. So we're really eager to try and relocate some of these feral cats.
All right. Well, good luck to both of you. And Lizzie Noble and Paul Salomon, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
I'm a survivor, not gonna give up, not gonna stop, work gonna work harder. I'm a survivor, I'm gonna make it. I'm a survivor, keep on surviving.
While the red-crested tree rat was making an appearance in Colombia, some other creatures were thrust into the spotlight as they joined the crew of Space Shuttle Endeavour. Robert Siegel spoke with NASA scientist Julie Robinson about some of Endeavour's smallest astronauts.
3, 2, 0, and liftoff for the final launch of Endeavour.
That is Space Shuttle Endeavour, blasting off from Florida this morning on the second-to-last shuttle mission ever. And you may have heard that this mission was added to the schedule to make sure that a certain piece of high-tech equipment makes it to space, a $2 billion device called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer 2. It'll be measuring cosmic particles. But we were equally intrigued by some of the smaller carry-on baggage for this mission, nematode worms, squid embryos, and Lego kits. And we're joined now by Julie Robinson, who's in charge of all of this as NASA's program scientist for the International Space Station. She's joining us from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Hi.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with the worms. Why send worms to space?
Worms are a really good organism for study because they have many of the same genes as higher organisms like ourselves do. But they're very small, they're easy to culture, and they're understood genetically very well.
And these worms have a pedigree.
Yes, we have had some worms that flew on the Columbia mission, and then they survived the reentry and were able to be cultured. And so these are many generations later descendants of some of those worms from Columbia.
What about the squid embryos? What are they doing on this mission?
So some of these organisms are flying primarily for educational purposes. The squid embryos were flown by a set of students that were interested in looking at how those embryos respond in microgravity.
Uh-huh. Well, the worms and the squid embryos, I guess, are a little bit easier to understand than the Lego. Why will the crew be playing with Lego on this mission?
One of the things that we do at NASA that we try to leverage with the excitement that goes with space missions is helping students to learn how focusing on careers in science and technology, the things that they need to do right now to be ready for those careers. And so the Lego partnership is one that we've built with Lego to get the kids that are excited about Legos and excited about space Legos, also focusing on some of the research and in the math and the things that go behind those missions in space.
But do Lego bricks perform any differently in space than they do on Earth?
Well, it depends on what you build with them.
Aha.
The Legos will be transferred to the International Space Station. Parts of them have been pre-built to support some different demonstration activities. And then the astronauts will carry out those demonstrations on the ISS, get video of the demonstrations, and then the video will be brought back to Earth.
What are the parts that were pre-assembled that are going up to the space station?
Basically, we pre-assembled some parts just so that the astronaut crews didn't have to spend a lot of time putting everything together to be ready for the first demonstrations.
You're giving them a break.
Right, and we need their time for the other purposes.
I guess so. Someone's got to look at the worms and the squid. Julie Robinson, Dr. Julie Robinson, Chief Scientist at NASA for the ISS, the International Space Station. Thanks for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
And now it's time for Worms in Space with our worm astronauts. Five very brave, very smart, very cute little worms.
Scientists aren't just taking living things into space. For more than 50 years, they've been trying to find life that might already be there. Now that effort is running out of money. Amy Standen of member station KQED has the story.
It takes a certain type of person to devote an entire career to chasing something she'll probably never find. One such person is Jill Tarter.
I'm the director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California.
SETI stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Mountain View is a long way from Hollywood. There, Jill Tarter's life was given a very different arc, at least as portrayed by Jodie Foster in the 1997 film Contact. In this scene, Ellie Arroway, Foster's character, hears the unmistakable signature of extraterrestrial intelligence over her headphones.
Is anybody awake in there? I'm moving the array! Confirm!
Boss, there's a bogey!
In real life, of course, the search has been a lot quieter. Tarter is in her 60s now. She wears her gray hair in a short, no-nonsense cut. She's been working on this for more than 40 years.
I don't know whether anyone ever will find a signal. I certainly don't know whether I will.
Back when Tarter started at the SETI Institute, the project received funding from NASA, but that support ended in 1993. Since then, she and others have spent almost as much time searching for money as they have searching for ET. Then, 3 years ago, the SETI Institute marked what felt like a turning point, the opening of the Allen Telescope Array, a field of 20-foot-wide radio telescopes in California's rural Hat Creek Valley, funded by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. Thanks to this Allen Telescope Array, which is jointly managed with the University of California, Berkeley, SETI scientists could scan the skies full-time, hoping a clear, telltale radio signal would stand out from the universe's background hiss.
We're looking for signals that are compressed in frequency, because nature doesn't do that. Technology does.
Now, to understand SETI, you have to understand this, that we humans are a very young species on a very young planet, and we've only had modern technology for the last couple hundred years. Tarter says it's a cosmic blip.
Our galaxy is 10 billion years old, And most of the stars in our region of the galaxy are about a billion years older than our sun.
In this broader scope of cosmic time, we humans are practically newborns.
We don't know if there are any other technologies out there, but if there are, we can be pretty sure they're older and more capable than we are.
Capable, she hopes, of beaming high-power radio waves that our telescopes could eventually pick up. But this is a long shot, perhaps the longest long shot in science, says Caleb Scharf, director of astrobiology at Columbia University.
All of those arguments ultimately rest on big assumptions that tend to be very human-centric.
For instance, that another civilization would use radio signals at all, or would have any interest in finding us. And then there's the problem of timing.
Even if there were many, many technological civilizations in our galaxy, the chances of one of them being radio loud,
that is, broadcasting a loud radio signal,
right at this instant, right at the time that we have the right technology to listen for it, the odds seems to shrink a lot.
But recently something happened that gave those odds a modest boost.
Engine start, 1-0, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket with Kepler on a search for planets in some way like our own.
NASA's Kepler telescope found signs of what it was looking for. Dozens of possible planets that might be similar to Earth, orbiting distant stars like our sun.
Some of these are potentially habitable planets.
Dimitar Sasolov is on the Kepler team. He also directs Harvard's Origins of Life initiative.
This is where we should be looking for the signals coming from other civilizations to start with. SETI is already in possession of that list.
But as of April, the SETI Institute has had to file that list away indefinitely. That's because California's budget is in crisis. Facing a $26 billion deficit, the state has made major cuts across the public university system. UC Berkeley says it can no longer afford to operate the Allen Array. The project is officially in hibernation. Jill Tarter says she's frustrated by the holdup.
Never before have we known such good potential targets at which to point our telescopes, and that's what we want to do.
Tarter wants to raise $5 million in private money to search the Kepler planets. Caleb Scharf, the Columbia astrobiologist we heard from earlier, says he thinks that's a bargain. Sure, SETI's a long shot, but science needs long shots.
Too often in modern science, we kind of narrow down our vision. We narrow down what we want to look at a little too much.
SETI, on the other hand, swings for the fences. The money may never pay off, says Scharf, but we'll never know unless we try.
I think the best argument for SETI is simply that we do not know. The only real solution is to look, and to look in as broad a way as you can.
Jill Tarter, for her part, says she knows she probably won't find ET in her lifetime. To find SETI a reliable source of funding, that would be achievement enough. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen in San Francisco.
And that's all for this week's Science Podcast. You can find all the stories you heard today at npr.org/sciencepodcast. I'm Adam Cole. Have a great week.